Okay. So any questions about the six harmonies before we go on to the next topic? Yeah.
My question about the harmony precepts.
Mm-hmm.
One is if you have written down the one or two rules.
You mean for
yeah.
here? Yeah. So if we've written down the rules for Shravasti Abhi, I have one file on my computer in which I'm writing things down. I haven't printed it out because I haven't finished writing everything. But a lot of the rules we just, you know, when you're introduced to the community, people, you know, tell you, or they should.
I'm getting to know some of them, but with the time, you know.
Yeah, and it would be helpful to have them written down. Yeah.
And then I have another question. How do you regard those precepts in the same problem of without it? We can't keep.
Okay. So there's a number of the precepts in the full ordination, whether you're male or female, that become quite difficult to keep in this day and age. So last week, I'm not sure if you were here, I was talking about that there's one vow not to ride in a vehicle, you know, and so it's because it creates arrogance and because sentient beings were usually being had to pull the conveyance. So, you know, the spirit of doing now is we have to ride in vehicles, but, you know, we ask the Buddhist permission, we confess that at Sojung, but more than that is we try not to be arrogant when we're riding in a vehicle and sit in a simple vehicle or in the simplest seat or something like that. So I think what's very important is to look at the purpose of the different precepts and why they were created, and try and keep the purpose. So there's one of the there's different classes of precepts in the Parimoksha, and the first class, if you break any of those completely, then you're no longer a monastic. The second class, if you break any of those, you know, completely, then you're temporarily suspended, and so you have to sit at the end of the line. You don't have your usual monastic privileges. And one of those for bhikshunis is not to go out alone. Okay? So that can become very difficult because if I were to keep that, then every place I traveled, there has to be another bhikshuni or a layperson who comes with me. And then that means every place has to pay two airfares, and that means, you know, I can't even take a walk in the forest, and, you know, a number of different things. So when I was in Taiwan, I spoke to one of the ordaining sangha about that and asked them, and they said that the purpose of that vow was for bhikshunis not to be in dangerous places. Yeah? So not to be in a place where, you know, you could be sexually abused or raped or physically assaulted, or not to be, you know, somewhere in a place or a time where it's dangerous. Because that precept was designed to protect, you know, bhikshunis from any kind of harm. And one of my friends told me a story, and to me, and this really illustrates, you know, how you would apply this, is she was driving home from her Dharma center one evening after they had a meeting. You know, there was a meeting of the committee of the Dharma Center, and she was driving home. She was a bhikshuni. She stopped for gas. It was maybe 11 o'clock at night, and there were some guys in the gas station who started harassing her. And I thought, this is a really perfect example. When you're a bhikshuni, you know, if you're driving a car, you should not be alone at night. Yeah, or if you're a bhikshuni and you're driving a long distance where you could have car trouble, you know, and be somewhere alone and have to rely on strangers, then you should not be alone. You should have somebody else with you. So to me, that would be a good example of how to update the meaning of keeping that precept nowadays. Okay, so you don't put yourself in any kind of situation that could be potentially dangerous or bothersome like that.
And then, at the time of Sojong, do you confess? Do you think that those need to be confessed, even though we know that it is people.
Right. Yeah, I think it's good at the time of sojourn to like mentally make a list of those, and when we do the verse of confession, you know, to think of those particularly. Yeah. Because there's several of them, like, you know, not bathing more than twice a month, you know. It's like, yeah. I mean, there's many things like that. You know, not handling money. Like here at the Abbey, we try as much as possible not to handle money. But then there's certain situations in which you do. I mean, for example, when I travel, I always have some money with me because I don't want to get stuck somewhere. I think that would be dangerous to myself as a good student, because I've gotten stuck sometimes somewhere, you know, with the flight's been canceled and, you know, there you go. So I carry money in those kinds of situations. So then those kinds of things, then, you know, we know and we confess, because there's two things in the precepts. There's naturally negative, there's Dikpa and Dikpa. Yeah, I think Dikpa is the negativity. In other words, the negative karma from doing that action. So if it's a naturally negative action, you know, like killing or stealing or lying or something like that, then there's this negativity, the negative karma that you accumulate by doing it. And then for the ones that, then any time, okay, put it this way. There, in our precepts, all of the precepts, you know, are, if we go beyond them, we have done something that was prohibited by the Buddha. Okay, because the Buddha had a precept about it. But some of the precepts are about naturally negative actions, and some of them are just prohibited because, you know, it's like impolite or it's inconvenient for somebody. Okay, so those actions, like for example, you know, playing music or something like that, that's not a naturally negative action. It's not something that if any time anybody does, you create negative karma. But if you have a precept not to do it and you do it, then you accumulate this drip, this obscuration, you know, from having gone, you know, transgressed that. If it's a naturally negative action, like a precept, not to slander, you know, we have one not to slander others, then if you do that, you accumulate the negative karma, because it's a naturally negative action, and then also the obscuration, because there's a precept prohibiting it. So the negative karma part of any action is purified by doing the four opponent powers. But the obscuration part of all of those is purified in our sojo. Yeah, and you do that in the presence of the community. And so that was one of the reasons why doing the posada, the sojourn, is important. And so when we're doing the confession prayer in those, then we're thinking of those actions. Yeah? Okay? Yeah. And of the ones that are not naturally negative, okay, so if we do them, like listening to music, you know, or entertainment or whatever, then there's the obscuration, the drip part, that is accumulated because it's something prohibited by the Buddha. On top of that, if you did it with a negative motivation, like a lot of attachment or a lot of anger or something like that, then you also accumulate the negative karma. But you don't necessarily get the negative karma if you did it just with a neutral motivation or you know, some other kind of motivation. Okay?
I have a two-part question pertaining to the harming of youth.
Mm-hmm.
Am I correct to assume that if someone had an open mind but maybe has a different interpretation of the same thing people are viewing,
mm-hmm.
that's not a bad thing. And if it isn't something that, and they have an open mind and they discuss it with other people who have a different interpretation, mm-hmm. is that spreading disharmony?
Mm. Okay, so if you're open-minded and you I have a different interpretation on something. Does that mean that there's disharmony of views or something? If you're all studying the same Buddhist text, for example, people are clearly going to have different interpretations. And so that's why you have discussion and debate, and that kind of thing is something that actually gets everybody to think more deeply about the teachings and is quite good. If somebody has a view that's just like way out in left field, then, you know, and they start propounding that, that could create disharmony. But if you're both trying to study the same text and understand what somebody's saying, I don't think so. Yeah. Yeah. Like I said, if somebody, you know, came in and said, oh, well, I've been reading the Prajnaparamita Sutra, and I think when Buddha said this, and this, that he means that there's a universal cosmic mind that we're all part of, and, you know, this is the real correct view that the Buddha was saying, then that would create some disharmony, okay, because it's something that the Buddha didn't teach. But if it's something where we're all trying to understand and people have different interpretations, that's quite natural. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. People come in with doubt saying, I'm not sure about my beliefs in God, I'm not sure about my beliefs in rebirth, and they want to discuss their doubts in order to try to see whether they're in the right place or whether they want to change their minds or that kind of discussion, I would assume would be actually beneficial.
So. Okay, so you're asking if somebody, it isn't sure if they believe in God or rebirth or karma and they want to have those kind of discussions, is that beneficial? That's beneficial, but that person should not be ordained as a monastic until they have their views clear.
Right.
Okay, because before you ordain as a monastic, you have to take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. So if you're not sure if you want to follow the Buddha as a teacher, then you don't take refuge. And if you think that you believe in God, then there's no sense in taking refuge. Okay, so all these things need to get cleared up, you know, before somebody ordains.
I'm interested in the community and not monastic, so it's kind of...
Yeah.
I'm just wondering how narrow the limit is. Like somebody who comes from a different Tibetan Buddhist tradition, can they find a way? And then also your experience with the Thai tradition and the Chinese tradition, and your experience with Tibetan, how is that in regard to this?
So the thing about having harmony and views. So, I mean, it depends very much on the individuals involved. Yeah, and if the individuals involved are very open-minded and so on, then, you know, within a number of Buddhist traditions, I think it's possible to live together. But if people have difficulty with that and they really prefer to live with people in their own tradition because the practices of other traditions bothers them in some way, then it's better they live in that kind of community. You know, we've been talking this winter, you know, there's one Catholic sister who lives nearby and she's expressed interest in doing a long retreat. And so we've been, you know, we're going to be talking with her next week about, you know, her maybe coming here and doing retreat. So we would have to see what she wants, what she's comfortable with, what we're comfortable with, because we wouldn't want a lot of the Q&A sessions to be involved in talking about God and what she's experiencing in her meditation about God, because that would distract from what we're trying to do in our medicine Buddha retreat. Okay? But if it's the case where, you know, she just wants a supportive group of people who are meditating together, you know, and sharing that experience of meditating so you can follow a schedule, then, you know, that could work quite well. But we don't want it to turn into kind of a big philosophical exchange about all sorts of views in the middle of a retreat. That, you know, would be quite disruptive for the retreat. Yeah. So it also depends, you know, how long somebody is staying in another community. And I think it's quite good for us to stay, you know, to sometimes visit different Buddhist communities, not to be a tourist and go from one to the next, but from time to time to visit. You know, Reverend Clarice is going to come and stay with us, and she's from a different tradition. And last year we found it all very enriching, didn't we, to have her here. And, you know, ask her how she practices and why she does things in a certain way and how her teacher does things and their training. And then she was quite interested in how we were doing things. And she learned about herself, the practice, which I think she's continued to do. She found that quite helpful for her personal practice. And her teacher checked with me and, you know, we talked about it and, you know. So I think it depends a lot on the individuals and the length of time, you know, what it is, and so on. Yeah. But I think it's quite nice when we have guest monastics from different traditions come here. I think there's a lot we can learn from each other. Yeah. Yeah. Now, whether it's a short period of time, that's one thing. If it's years, then it's another thing.
I'm wondering about the harmony and precepts. Are the precepts in the different traditions like Moshe Bakalayan, are they actually different precepts? Or are they different interpretations of the same?
Okay, so in the different Vinayas, are there different sets of precepts or are there just different interpretations of the same precepts? When the Buddha taught, he just set up the different precepts as Buddhism spread in different parts of India and then later Sri Lanka and other places. For the first 500 years, everything was passed down orally. So it's quite natural that you have some variations in the schools that started because of geographic difference or slightly different interpretations of different things. And considering that the tradition was passed down orally for 500 years, there's actually remarkably little difference among the precepts. Yet there are differences. Some of the differences are quite minor. They're in terms of the number of precepts. So, for example, with the Bhikshuni precept, in the Pali tradition there's 311, in Dharmaguptaka there's 348, in Mulashravastavada there's 364. Okay? So sometimes there's different numbers. You might have something that is one precept in one tradition that's broken out into two or three precepts in one of the other traditions. Okay, so some of those might be quite similar. But then sometimes you might have, like there's a whole block of about 25 precepts regarding your behavior with a stupa that you find in the Dharmagupta tradition, but you don't find it in the Pali tradition. Okay? And then some of the precepts, they're quite similar, but just minor differences of what it means to break them. Yeah. But they are very, you know, considering quite similar. Yeah. But like I said, how things transpired historically is different. You know, I mean, there is a precept, for example, not a precept. This is one of your resources to have alms food. But, you know, when Buddhism went to China, then if you stayed in the city where you could collect alms, then it was very easy to get caught in the politics. And so they wanted to meditate. They moved out to the mountains. So then it was difficult to go for alms. So then they started cultivating the land. Now there's precepts about digging the earth. Yeah, I'm not supposed to do that, but when you're living outside of the city, and, you know, they did it. The reason for it makes a lot of sense to me. Who wants to get caught up in politics? Then you can see how they then allowed their monastics to dig the earth and to grow and things like that. But whereas you would never find in Thailand any of the monastics doing that. Okay, are we ready to go on to the next topic? Or like in the Tibetan tradition, you know, where they have thousands of monastics. Can you imagine, like in Lhasa before 1959, if they all went on alms round? Oh, I mean, the lay people, they would be broken. There's no way they could do that. They would, you know, Drepung had 10,000 and Sarah had, what, about 4,000? No, about 7,000, 8,000. If they all came into Lhasa every day, You know? So they didn't do that. So then, you know, people brought food there, and then people offered them land, and they started cultivating the land, or they had lay people who cultivated the land. This was part of it, actually the problem why there was the communist revolution, because, you know, the monasteries had become huge landowners with poor lay people working the lands. Yeah. But that's the way it happened, as, you know, as an economic system rather than going into town. And also when you're doing debate studies, you know, to walk into town, walk back, and, you know, that's the next time.